Of course, none of the clocks have fallen back here, just in case you're curious. Hell, daylight savings only happened a couple weeks ago. This is hell. Manufacturing dissent since 1996, this is hell. During the 2015 Greek Spring, citizens rose up against continued bailouts of the economy by the Troika, consisting of the European Commission, which operates the European Union, European Central Bank, and IMF, that would put the country into more and more debt. They also opposed the austerity measures that were leading to a surge in the loss of Greek dignity and self-respect, culminating in a massive increase in suicides. The Troika crushed that rebellion, and our first guest this week says that led to the rise of the far right, which led to Brexit, which led to Trump, which led to Vladimir Putin being happier than he ever imagined. Returning for the third time here on This Is Hell to explain it all to us, former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, is author of the new book, Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. Yanis is the co-founder of an international grassroots movement, DIEM25, Democracy in Europe Movement 25. There's campaigning for the revival of democracy in Europe. Yanis has been on in the past to discuss his earlier books and The Weak Survive What They Must, as well as the book The Global Minotaur. Yanis is currently a professor of economics at the University of Athens in Greece. Find out more about Yanis at yanisvaroufakis.eu. How is that spelled? The exact same way it sounds. Follow Yanis on Twitter at Yanis Varoufakis, except there's a U in the middle. Following Yanis during today's abbreviated 75-minute This Is Hell, one of our correspondents is going to do something the New York Times refuses to do. Our correspondent Brian Muir, who reports to us regularly from Sao Paulo, Brazil, is going to tell us what happened when he, get this, talks to people on the left in Brazil. I know, right? Why the hell would anyone want to hear from the Brazilian left? I mean, all they've done is overthrow a dictatorship and get the last two elected presidents, well, elected. Why talk to the left when you can focus all your attention on the relatively wealthy minority dictatorship-supporting far-right that has proved so unpopular? The only way they can get power is through an impeachment that many outsiders saw more as a coup. We'll find out what happened when Brian did the unthinkable, as far as the New York Times is concerned, talked to the Brazilian left. Brian is an editor of Brazil Wire and a freelance writer and producer. This week, Brian posted the article, The State of the Brazilian Left, Analysis from an American in Brazil, at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, on their website, where Brian is listed as, quote, an extramural contributor. And I think that's what we should call our correspondents from now on. Extramural contributors. I'm your bitter, blind, broke, gap-toothed radio show host, Chuck Mertz. Producing this week's This Is Hell is Alex Jerry. Alex, what's new by you?
I'm trying to call myself so I can hear on the phone if the phone can hear you.
All right. And you might want to do that because I think during my monologue today I might say penis over a dozen times.
Oh boy.
This Is Hell is broadcast live without interruption on WNUR 89.3 FM, Evanston, Chicago Sound Experiment. Streaming live online at our website, thisishell.com. Podcast shortly after at the same place, thisishell.com. And now airing in an abbreviated one-hour version on Sunday mornings in Moscow, Idaho, on Radio Free Moscow, KRFP, and on Lumpen Radio in Chicago Southside. If you want to hear This Is Hell over the air on your local radio station, assuming you still have one, and impose our hellish content upon your neighbors, email us your local radio station's call letters to chuck@thisishell.com. And some of you are already suggesting local stations for us to include in our burgeoning Not the Media Network, or maybe we should call it Broadcasting Empire. And we'll tell you which stations during listener feedback after our conversation with Yanis Varoufakis. Again, if you want to hear us on your local favorite radio station, email us the call letters to chuck@thisishell.com, or better yet, email your local station and tell them why your source for anti-social media is This Is Hell. Brave enough to be live, dumb enough to be goofy, stupid enough to think that we could be a regular part of your weekly hangover. Alex has this week's hangover cure.
Just one piece of advice first. Don't call it an empire. We're going to get a blowback from people with Stalin avatars on that one.
Sweet.
This week's hangover cure is
Stalin avatar.
Advil, sleep, food, water, and more drinking. In the article posted earlier this month at bonappetit.com with the impeccable title, 17 Hangover Cures from Random New Yorkers Out on a Saturday Night, they talk with Tara, Charlotte, and Shauna between 1st and 2nd Ave on 2nd Street. Tara says that when trying to cure a hangover, she takes another shot first thing in the morning. Charlotte says her cure is Advil and going back to sleep, and then don't talk to me for 2 weeks. I don't bounce back like I used to. Shauna fixes her hangover with some food and a lot of water, maybe a round or two later that day. That makes this week's hangover cure, courtesy of Tara, Charlotte, and Shauna, between 1st and 2nd Ave on 2nd Street, Advil, sleep, food, water, and more drinking, but don't talk to Charlotte for another 2 weeks.
You are listening to God's favorite radio show. Prove us wrong. This is Hell. The following is a public service announcement to all people who have penises. Notice, I am not saying to all men, because I don't care what gender you identify with. As long as there is a penis attached to your body somewhere, anywhere, I don't care where, this public service announcement is for you. Please, people with penises, please, at all times, unless there is a request, preferably in written form, not some implied suggestion or something you are reading between some lines, please, keep your penises in your pants at all times, unless the following circumstances are occurring. Number one, you must urinate. Number two, you are in the process of changing your attire. Number three, your penis is being attacked by fire ants. And aside from those three reasons, I cannot imagine any other reason to take your penis out of your pants. Again, unless it has been requested, and I would strongly advise that you get that request in triplicate. I have, too, in my past, pulled my penis out of my pants without any form of request, written or otherwise. But I was young, drunk, and stupid, and seeing as how later this evening I will again be two of those three things, being young, drunk, and stupid is not an excuse. However, I was not displaying my penis as some sort of manhood weapon targeting unsuspecting victims. I more use it as a tool to paint a communal mural at a party I was hosting. So really, it was kind of a collaboration. And a quick tip for those of you who are planning on using your penis as some sort of paintbrush. When using tempera, make certain to clean your brush thoroughly afterward, or else it will get all stiff, crazed, and cracked, and you won't be able to use your brush again. Even worse, the next morning, you will awake to the shock surprise of a periwinkle tinkle, and even a person as colorblind as I am knows something wrong when you've got all periwinkle down there. I cannot stress this enough, people who have penises. Do not pull them out of your pants. It's not that nobody wants to see it. Some people do, just like some people like to watch those cliche-riddled, overly sappy Christmas movies on the Hallmark Channel at this time of year, while the rest of us would rather suddenly die from our sun going supernova. Just like Hallmark Christmas movies, the vast majority of us really does not want to see your penis. And you know what else? We don't want to talk about it either. Of course, I've talked about mine, but only with those who had a vested interest in my penis, like my girlfriend, doctor, or landlord. The worst conversation you can have about your penis is when you are purchasing condoms, because depending on the type you're about to buy, you will be judged, and you don't know how, which makes it even more frustrating. What if I buy ribbed, original, natural, lamb, non-latex directs with the reservoir tip? What does that say about me to the cashier behind the counter? I have no idea, and it can be very, very frustrating, even confusing. Do they think because I use Durex, I'm clearly a fascist? Maybe if I switch to Lifestyle's lubricated bearskins, they'll realize I voted for Bernie. Again, everybody with penises. Keep them in your pants, and to be honest, keep any thoughts you have on your penis to yourself or a qualified professional. For everyone, whether you have a penis or not, please, please keep your hands to yourself. I know that cool person says it will be hilarious if a photographer took a picture of you groping them, but groping is not funny, and that person asking you to grope them for a picture is definitely not cool. The world is not your hand's produce aisle full of stuff for you to squeeze. In reality, it's more like a lending library where you have to have the proper ID and get permission to check something out. In fact, it's more like the reference desk where not only do you have to ask permission, but you have to return the item in the very near future, still in the condition it was in when you originally checked it out. Now, I never thought when I started this radio show, or whatever radio career I have, that I would need to go on air and explain why people should keep their penises in their pants, or whatever you choose to wear, as well as their hands to themselves. But it seems that I have to. The long list of people who are apparently not heeding this advice grows every day, from those you had no respect for in the past to those who you greatly admire. If you didn't like them already, the unwarranted advances by people in power can reaffirm your distaste for the individual, revealing to you why all their policies are sexist, unfair, and unequal. If those accused are people you admire, who knows? Maybe it was a long time ago, and isn't it weird that the victim is only coming out now about this inappropriate behavior? Besides, the perp apologized and their work is too important to be abandoned now. To be honest, I don't even know if I can trust the accuser. Did you see that show they went on to talk about the abuse? There's been talk online and at the bar, which is where I get most my news commentary, because I know that can't be faked by Putin, although I do suspect that one guy who drinks wine at the end of the bar all by himself, I suspect he's a Ruski operative. There's been talk of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for sexual abuse, like the one they had in South Africa following apartheid in an attempt to heal the national wounds created by that racist system. A racist system that was supported by Ronald Reagan. That we need some way to address these festering wounds of sexism, misogyny, patriarchy, and everything that goes into a system that imposes so many rules and roles on women and what they are supposed to be in our male-dominated and determined world. With people in every branch of power wielding power through sexual abuse and intimidation, we do need some way in which we can address this hate-driven behavior. And maybe truth and reconciliation is the answer. But for now, if you could all just keep it in your pants, keep your thoughts of what's in your pants to yourself, and hands off without explicit permission, at least in duplicate, we'll be taking steps in the right direction. To be honest, I can't believe I have to announce this on the air. But I guess it's just further proof that this is hell. You can now become a supporter of This Is Hell via Patreon. If you become a regular Patreon supporter, not only will we show our appreciation by sending you some This Is Hell subvertising stickers, but you'll also have access to special perks, including every week getting a classic interview from our back catalog of 20-plus years of on-air conversations selected by me, with a new up-to-date introduction on why I selected that interview for our Patreon supporters. And in the future, you'll get additional bonus gifts as a Patreon subscriber at thisishell.com/support. This week's Patreon podcast, exclusively and only for Patreon subscribers, will be our first interview we ever did with Naomi Klein, dating back to the year 2000, when we talked to Naomi about her book, No Logo. And if you subscribe to Patreon this week, there's a possibility that we'll be sending you a free copy of her most recent book, Naomi Klein's most recent book, This Changes Everything. But the only way you can hear that or win the book is becoming a subscriber to our Patreon podcast at thisishell.com/support. And that weekly podcast exclusively for Patreon patrons not only has an interview from our archives each and every week that is not currently available online, but also includes one of my hilariously insightful monologues, like today's, like the way I start each broadcast of This Is Hell. On last week's Patreon podcast, I gave my eulogy for the late, great Edward S. Herman, co-author of Manufacturing Consent with Noam Chomsky. If you sign up for Patreon, you can hear that and all our Patreon podcasts so far. We've done in the last, I think, 5 or 6 months. So for now, if you want more hell in your life, this is the only way you can do it. Go to thisishell.com/support and subscribe via Patreon. We want to thank the people who joined us as Patreon subscribers this week at thisishell.com/support. Thanks to Thomas J., Dennis H., Ryan M., Daniel A. That makes 156 Patreon patrons so far. Help us attain our completely random and arbitrarily derived goal for this month, which is 200 subscribers by December 1st. Without your help, we can't reach our completely and arbitrarily set goal. Thanks to everyone who supported This Is Hell this week and in the coming days, weeks, months, and years. Your support will be needed more than ever as dissent continues to be shunned by the establishment corporate mainstream media. Coming up on this week's This Is Hell, Yiannis Varoufakis tracks the mess we are in today with the rise of the far right back to the crushing of the Greek debt rebellion against the Western establishment. And correspondent Brian Meir will report live from Sao Paulo and tell us what we're missing when the New York Times does not talk to or report on Brazil's left. We hope to also get to listener feedback, what's happening on upcoming episodes of This Is Hell. And for now, let's just say there will be more. Noam Chomsky called This Is Hell sanity in talk radio. So clearly and sadly, Noam's gone insane. This is Hell. 2 years ago, almost three now, our next guest appeared on This Is Hell and warned us about the rising far right in Europe and how they could be and would be provoked by the EU, which was increasingly acting in an authoritarian manner. He turned out to be correct. Here to tell us what role the crushing of the Greek spring played in Brexit, the rise of Trump and the far right, leading to sheer delight for Vladimir Putin, former finance minister of Greece, Yiannis Varoufakis, author of the new book, Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. Welcome back to This Is Hell, Yiannis.
It's very good to be back.
It's always great to have you on the show. This is your third appearance on the show, and I could not be more delighted. This book is yet again fantastic. Your other two books earlier that we've discussed on the show, I really enjoyed as well. This book, Adults in the Room, is really great. You were first on our show in January 2015, and during that conversation, you told us that you feared the rise of the nationalist right in Europe as a response to the actions taken by the Troika, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, IMF, when it came to the debts of European nations like Greece and the planned austerity to address those budgets. To what degree have your fears come true? Is Europe today gone as far to the nationalist right as you expected? Not as far, farther? How would you assess that prediction at this point in time?
Well, more or less, the degree of misanthropy that I was fearing has materialized. But look, it's interesting that you mentioned the last time we spoke was January of 2015, because it so happened that approximately 1 month later, I said exactly the same things in the capacity of being Minister of Finance of Greece in the meeting of all the European finance ministers, the so-called Eurogroup. And I recall in my maiden speech, as they say, in my first speech, you know, rookies in that meeting, in the Eurogroup meeting, get the opportunity to present their program and to be greeted by their fellow finance ministers. I finished my speech, which was a bit technical, as it should be, but with a political statement, very similar to what we discussed, what you and I discussed. I said that, look, I understand that most of you are discomfited by the fact that in your midst you have a Minister of Finance elected by the radical left coalition of Greece. I fully understand that. But what I'm bringing to you and what our election is bringing to you is an opportunity. We are anti-establishment figures. We are severe critics of the policies that have been pursued in my country and elsewhere in Europe for a number of years now. But nevertheless, we are fierce Democrats. We are democratic to our bone, and we're Europeanists. We do not want the European Union to disintegrate. We want to strengthen our European Union. But mind you, if you try to crash our government, if you ignore the democratic mandate that we received by the Greek people, there's a very good chance that you will succeed in stamping upon us and even overthrowing us. But if you do, the only true beneficiaries of this will be the forces of the ultra-right, the xenophobes, the racists, the alt-right, those who want to disintegrate the European Union, and those who will turn against you in precisely the same way that we experienced in the 1930s during another period of deflationary forces. So that did not go down very well, as you can imagine. But the result is that they ended up with a crisis exactly as I had imagined, because, you know, Le Pen, the neo-fascist leader in France, got 35% of the vote, which is absolutely astonishing. Austria now has a clearly racist government. Poland and Hungary have shifted to the recalcitrant xenophobic right. And even within Germany, the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, is facing an ultra-right-wing racist insurrection, both within the parliament in the form of the Alternative for Deutschland, clearly racist party, but also within her own ranks, her own political party.
What would, how much worse would have the situation been if the Greek debt rebellion wasn't crushed? Because I would assume that the EU, the Troika, made a decision, looking at their bottom line, what is best for this situation? Should we crush the Greek rebellion, or should we try to accommodate it in some way, try to negotiate with it in some way? So how much was this Greek debt rebellion being crushed? How much was that just a bad idea when you look at it in the long run for what's best for the Troika itself?
It was definitely a bad idea because it was like a boomerang. It came back and bit them, so to speak. The rise of the pro-Brexit vote in the United Kingdom had a number of factors that determined it. There's no doubt that it was there were multiple causes there, but I can assure you that the reason why Brexit won, and it won, remember, with a sliver of a majority, 1.8% of the total vote. I can assure you that because I did campaign in Britain, across Britain, against Brexit, for reasons that we can discuss if you wish, or not maybe. But nevertheless, in my campaign during the period leading to the referendum, I encountered thousands of people in Britain who said to me that they would vote for Brexit for the simple reason that they could not stand the authoritarianism and the incompetence of Brussels, of the European Union, in the way that they crushed our government and dealt with our people. It's my considered opinion that that 1.8% probably underrepresents the proportion of Brits who looked at the way in which the European Union dealt with a sovereign nation and a sovereign parliament, effectively staging a coup d'etat against us, and said, no, we do not want to be part of this European Union. So the disintegration of Europe has already begun as a result of the authoritarianism of Brussels. It's very similar to what's happening in Catalonia today. Think about it. It is as if Madrid is trying to get rid of Catalonia by sending the troops in, the armored civil guard, to beat up voters in the pro-independence in the referendum. My view is that if they had not done that, independence would not have won, would not have carried that referendum. So in Europe, the deep establishment, as I call it in the subtitle of the book, they're just being completely idiotic from their own perspective, the perspective of their own criteria. But look, it's not something completely new. Every time we watch a Shakespearean play, whenever you watch, for instance, Lady Macbeth, you see this happening in front of you. These are smart, powerful people who make one mistake and compile it upon the next. And the result is that they get their comeuppance in the end. Now, I don't feel sorry for them for getting their comeuppance, but I do feel sorry for the broader public, the majority, the many, who suffer as a result of this combination of incompetence and authoritarianism by the deep establishment.
Where do you think the EU would be today if the Troika had acquiesced to the Greek rebellion against debt?
Oh, it would have been a far better place, and it would have been far more powerful in the sense of legitimacy amongst Europeans, because it was not a question of acquiescing to us. If you look at the proposals I was taking to them, they were exceptionally moderate. It took a radical left-wing minister of finance to take to them very moderate, middle-of-the-road policy proposals. But, you know, that's, this is not new. I mean, think of the political program and the economic program that Bernie Sanders put to the American people. If you look at it dispassionately, it was a very moderate program. There was nothing particularly socialist about it. And it was a New Deal kind of program. But this is what has happened to our world, both in the United States and in the European Union. Moderate New Deal kind of proposals are portrayed and vilified by the establishment as loony left, you know, incompetent programs. The result is that the Troika wins in Europe and Donald Trump wins in the United States. And then suddenly the liberal establishment that has vilified us for the New Deal kind of approach that we've put to our peoples suddenly starts screaming blue murder that Trump defeated them. And they start looking for scapegoats as to why they lost. They lost because they were authoritarian and incompetent.
Why does this situation in Europe create a fertile environment for the far right and not a fertile environment for the far left? Or has it done that, and that's just something that is not something we're seeing in our media?
No, crisis, recession leading to depression, deflation, that is falling prices and negative interest rates, always favor the extreme right. They do not create revolutionary dynamics. Think of the 1930s. It was not the left that benefited in Europe, or anywhere else for that matter, from the Great Depression. If it wasn't for the New Deal in the United States, you would have a similar explosion of the far right. In Europe, take Hitler. Let's take just that one vicious example. There is an illusion doing the rounds internationally, but particularly in Europe and in Germany, that Adolf Hitler was elevated to power by hyperinflation. This is not true. If you look at the period of hyperinflation in Germany, which was the early and mid 1920s, you'll find that his National Socialist Party, his Nazi Party, was doing really badly at the polls. It was when a government, a liberal establishment government under Herr Brüning, introduced massive austerity that reduced the income of the working class and increased unemployment and created deflation. It was then that the Nazis skyrocketed in Germany and in all surrounding satellite countries like Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and so on and so forth, leading to even the Franco regime in Spain and to the Nazi regime, the fascist regime that we had in Greece in 1936. So just like then, again today, we had a financial crisis which began in Wall Street. Our 1929, our generation 1929 took place in 2008. Very soon after that, the establishment turned to austerity in order to shift the burdens created by the collapsing banks onto the shoulders of the weakest of voters, of citizens. And then very soon after that, you had deflationary forces breeding political monsters on the right. Nothing is new. We are repeating the same history just because we haven't learned from it.
And as you touched on earlier, you were opposed to Brexit, yet here you were, somebody who was incredibly critical of the Troika and the European Union's policies towards Greece. So how do you explain how you can both be somebody who is critical of the EU, even calling their actions at times authoritarian? How can you at the same time be against Brexit, be against Britain leaving the EU?
Well, the way I think about it, emotional, sentimental, but also the political, is this. I spent my youth, like many others, protesting on the streets against my government, because I believe that patriots have a duty to protest against their governments when their governments are wrong. That does not mean that I wanted to see the dissolution of the Greek state or the Greek government. I wanted a different government. I wanted different policies. I wanted a different political culture in my country. I did not want the disintegration of my country. Similarly, as a Europeanist, precisely because I'm a Europeanist, I feel that I have a moral and political duty to fight against the establishment which is running the show in Brussels and in Frankfurt, where the Central Bank of Europe is. Not because I am against you, but because I am a pro-European Democrat. That's one, if you want, dimension of my answer. The second dimension of my answer is that, and it's a response to good progressives, friends of mine, who disagree with me on this, and whose argument is, well, look, you should not compare your nation state with the European Union. The European Union was a neoliberal artifact. Let's get rid of it. Let's go back to our nation states and let's reinvigorate democracy within the nation state. The reason why this argument does not convince me is because, come to think of it, what is going to happen if this European Union disintegrates, if we all leave like Britain left? Well, what's going to happen is something quite atrocious. We're going to have the disintegration of the common currency, the euro, a terrible currency, a very badly designed currency. But nevertheless, its disintegration is going to lead Germany to reconstitute its old currency, the Deutschmark, maybe get many other countries to its east and maybe to its south to join that common German currency. Countries like Poland, like Hungary, like the Czech Republic, Slovakia, the Baltic states, Austria, Holland. And those countries, because they together as a bloc, as an economic bloc, have a massive trade surplus with the rest of the world, will see to it that their currency goes through the roof. So suddenly there's going to be a massive unemployment wave hitting those countries while prices are falling, deflation. The rest of Europe is going to have a combination of inflation and low investment and unemployment. Europe is going to become a cesspit of right-wing politics. The circumstances that I just described, if they come to bear, there will be circumstances that will turbocharge even further the alt-right, the racist right, the xenophobes. Is this a good place for us Democrats and left-wingers to regain power and reinvigorate our democracies in our nation states? I don't think so.
We are speaking with former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis. Yanis is author of the new book, Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. You can find out more about Yanis at yanisvaroufakis.eu, and you can follow Yanis on Twitter at Yanis Varoufakis. You write that after the Greek rebellion against the EU was quashed, leading to, among other things, the rise of the right and Trump. You write that once upon a time, the democratic project was about the readiness to pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure their survival and the success of liberty, to use JFK's stirring words. Alas, those ideals had been expunged from the practices of the West's leading power a long, long time ago, and the story of Greece in 2015 offers a grandstand view of this loss. In your opinion, if liberty is no longer the democratic project's goal, or what is whatever today's project can be called, what is its goal rather than liberty?
I don't believe that they have goals anymore. In 2008, the certainties that governed the thinking of the liberal establishment collapsed along with the financial sector. And then, of course, in Washington, D.C. and in New York City, those very pragmatic bankers and functionaries, people like Hank Paulson, formerly Goldman Sachs, at the time was your Treasury Secretary, they got around the table and they did what they knew to do in order to refloat the banks. And everything else was secondary. Everything was secondary. Suddenly there was no project except to refloat the financial sector, which was their own private realm, if you want. And after that, they just made it up as they went along, both in the United States and in Europe. This is exactly what happened in Europe. European the European establishment figures that sat around a much larger table trying to salvage the European financial sector were far less pragmatic, far less smart, allow me to say, than the American counterparts. They botched the job compared to what the Americans did. The result was a much greater recession and the forces of disintegration that are ripping Europe apart. But on both sides of the Atlantic, what you have is this very interesting situation where the establishment is rudderless. They don't have they are beyond their own ideological illusions. Think of it, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, whatever we think of them, actually believed in their cause. They believed deep down in that idiocy of the trickle-down effect. They believed that if they give more wealth to the rich, the world is going to be better. Margaret Thatcher was a genuine ideologue. She had no compunction. She had absolutely no restraint. She would go into the people, into the homes of working-class people and try to convince them that it was in their interest to crush the trade unions, that it was in their interest to have a massive shift of wealth to the rich. She believed in it. Now, she was wrong, of course, but she was a conviction politician. So what I'm effectively saying is that that era during which the neoliberals actually believed in what they were doing, they had an overarching ideology, a goal, they believed that they were agents of good. That has gone. After 2008, all you ended up with is functionaries of the deep state, of the deep establishment, minding their own interests, propagating their own careers, looking after their mates in the financial sector, practicing the fine art of the revolving doors, going from the state sector, from administration to Wall Street, and then from Wall Street back to the administration, with a cynicism and a kind of punitive attitude towards the poor, towards the needy, towards the weak, which was completely bereft of any grand political plan for the betterment of society.
You are saying that liberalism, in a sense, mainstream liberalism today is incoherent. We had Corey Robin on our show earlier this year, who's an amazing political analyst, especially in the U.S. here of the right. And he talks about how mainstream conservatism has become incoherent as well. What does understanding that both mainstream conservatism and mainstream liberalism being incoherent, how does that reveal, what does that reveal to us about the state of U.S. politics or Western establishment politics today, when it seems like both the conventional ideas of liberalism and the conventional ideas of conservatism have been abandoned and their ideals are now pretty incoherent?
No, I agree entirely with the analysis. Entirely. Because let's not forget that liberalism and conservatism from the 19th century onwards have been accomplices. They present themselves as foes, but they're not. They need each other. One feeds off the other. This is why it's very difficult to define liberalism. In the United States, to be a liberal is almost to be a communist. In Canada, it means something else. In Britain, it means something else. In Australia, the Liberal Party is the Conservative Party. There is an identification of the two. It all has to do with the ideology of capital accumulation. Allow me to go back to my old left-wing Marxist tradition. This is how I understand the world. Capital accumulation, profiteering, if you want, was not always the driving force of societies. It was not the case with feudalism or previous societies. It is the case exclusively with capitalism. Now, the role of a state, for instance, and the role of conservatism is to create, if you want, an insurance policy for the rich, for those who are accumulating wealth through the capitalist process. Because the state makes the streets safer to the extent that it also distributes or issues food stamps. It makes the poor more civilized and less threatening to the rich. So there is a tendency within the social class that that relies on the accumulation of private wealth in the hands of the few, to be more conservative in the sense of being more, if you want, at the same time, liberal in social policies, to promote social stability, state protection, and so on and so forth. But at the very same time, the rich, the capitalists, to use an old-fashioned expression, fear the state, which they need. Because if the state has the capacity to use violence, for instance, against the working class, against anyone who rises up against the status quo, then surely that same state can use the same violence against them to confiscate their property, to increase inheritance taxes, and so on and so forth. So the ruling class, the bourgeoisie, as we used to say, has a very interesting relationship with the state and the state institutions' conservative elements and tendencies. It needs them, and it loves them at the same time. So, if I'm right in what I said before, that liberalism, that you mentioned the JFK quotation, that this kind of pro-capitalist dimension is in crisis, then conservatism is also in crisis. Because, as I said, the two are accomplices. You can't have one thriving and the other in crisis.
On power relations, you write, whenever a politician in the know gives a journalist an exclusive in exchange for a particular spin that is in the politician's interest, the journalist is appended, however unconsciously, to a network of insiders. Whenever a journalist refuses to slant their story in the politician's favor, they risk losing a valuable source and being excluded from that network. This is how networks of power control the flow of information through co-opting outsiders and excluding those who refuse to play ball. They evolve organically and are guided by a supra-intentional drive that no individual can control, not even the President of the United States, the CEO of Barclays, or those manning the pivotal nodes in the IMF or national governments. So if they happen organically, is it part of human nature? Is it a failing of ours as humans that is insurmountable? Is the personal human pursuit of power, our desire for power, are undoing?
No, not at all. There's nothing natural about it. Look, let me give you a very simple example. If a group of friends sit around the table to play a game of Monopoly, then whatever their personal characteristics, their human nature, whatever, the rules of the game are designed in such a way that someone is going to become the monopolist. To say that it is in human nature not to cooperate, but to try to knock each other out until one of us becomes the monopolist, would be a major mistake. What we should admit is that, you know, this particular game has been designed with rules that bring about this outcome. But human nature is remarkably diverse. We have wonderful capacities to design different games. And indeed, if I remember correctly, the original Monopoly, more than 100 years ago, came with two sets of rules, and players could choose which set of rules they would adopt. One is the one that we all know about, but there was an alternative set of rules that allowed everyone to amass property and everyone through collaboration to flourish. Except that game was not particular; was open ended. It didn't end because if everybody can get richer and richer, or happier and happier. So the point I'm making is that there is a terrible illusion that we live under, that the ruling class is very keen to propagate and to impose upon us and to make us labor under, that capitalism is a natural mode of production, a natural system of economic organization. It isn't. It is a game which humanity stumbled upon during one of the phases of its development. It has given us a great deal of important stuff, like computers and automobiles and trains and electricity generation at a large scale. But it's not fit for purpose anymore. And we need to establish new rules of the game, and a new game that utilizes this machinery especially artificial intelligence and so on, and instead of having us human beings being the slaves of our own artifacts, to reverse the situation, so we can actually use the stuff that we produce in order to increase shared prosperity.
You write how shortly after your resignation as Greek finance minister, due to refusal to sign the Troika's bailout plan, you got a phone call from Panagiotis Danis, quote, with whom we had set up the finance ministry's team of untouchables charged with the algorithmic hunt for tax cheats. They're about to pull the plug, he told me, just when we were about to catch hundreds of thousands of large-scale tax evaders raking in billions for the state. You add that you looked at the memorandum of understanding that they wanted you to sign, buried in its verbiage. There it was, a provision for the Troika-dominated tax office to absorb Danis's team and thus defang it. To you, what explains why the Troika would not want you to find the tax cheats who had played a major role in the economic challenges that were facing Greece?
Well, isn't it the story of everyone here in Greece, where you are in the United States, that the deep state, the deep establishment, is the oligarchy's best friend? In the episode that you just recounted, and thank you for doing this, lies the answer to the question that many people ask me. They say to me, but Yanis, didn't the Greeks bring the crisis upon themselves? Wasn't it their tax evasion and laxity regarding paying tax that did it? Well, firstly, there is no such thing as the Greeks. There are Greeks who pay their taxes through the nose and right on time. There were other Greeks, especially the rich ones, who never did and never do, like in the United States as well. In Greece, we had a lot more tax evasion for reasons that are not of interest now. But what is fascinating, and this is why this extract that you read is important, is that in the public domain in Northern Europe, in the United States, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, the adults in the room, allow me to say, have been presented as the sensible, rational, technocratic people who came to Greece and tried to teach Greeks manners. Try to teach Greeks how to pay their taxes, how to do the right thing, how not to bask in the sun all day singing and dancing and drinking, and instead do some hard work. That is the public narrative, if you want, the propaganda. The reality is that while being exceptionally harsh on the little people, you know, on the old age pensioner who simply does not have enough money to pay a 24% sales tax, and the small-scale grocery store that is about to go bankrupt, and if it charges 24% sales tax to that pensioner, he will go bankrupt. Maybe, yes, they do trade under the table without paying that 24%. And I'm not condoning this, but what I'm saying is that you have the Troika that crushes these people, you know, treats them with incredible disciplinarianism, while at the very same time, the Greek bankers who committed monstrous atrocities, who wasted public funds, who were bailed out again and again to the tune of billions that the little people borrowed on their behalf. Not only have they been left alone, but they were actually used by the Troika in order to spearhead the coup d'etat against our government, and I have to say against me personally as well, that led to the demise of the team of untouchables that would have caught 450,000 tax cheats in a country of 10 million souls. So, as I say in the book, the deep establishment, and the Troika in our case, is the oligarchy's best mate.
Yeah, and they didn't want you to go after the tax cheats. They didn't want you to go after the tax evaders, but they did want to open up Greece to gambling, which is just another amazing revelation. It really reveals a lot about the Troika itself when they're willing to not go after people who have cheated, but then willing to bring in one of the most exploitative things that you can have for the poor. One last question for you, Yiannis. And before I ask my final question for you, I just want to tell you that I had about 65 questions written out for you. I think I got to 3 of them because I just enjoy having conversations and discussions with you so much, because I just end up doing follow-up questions to what you have to say. I just really always appreciate you being on the show, Yiannis. Former finance minister
of Greece,
Yiannis Varoufakis, is author of the new book, Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. You can find out more about Yiannis by going to yiannisvaroufakis.eu. And if you haven't read his earlier books, And the Weak Suffer What They Must and The Global Minotaur, you can get them through his website, and they are fantastic as well. Follow Yiannis on Twitter at Yiannis Varoufakis. One last question for you, Yiannis. And as always, it's the question from hell, the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, our audience is going to hate your response. In capitalism, because, you know, as I was just saying, the last time we had you on the show was in April of 2016, and the book then that you had just published was And the Weak Suffer What They Must. In capitalism, how difficult is it to, if not impossible, to eliminate the profit incentive from suffering?
Oh, it's extremely hard. But then again, there is absolutely no alternative to keep struggling for it, because the profit incentive, when it is associated as well and fueled by private ownership of increasingly productive machinery, as in artificial intelligence, is going to wipe us out. And it's going to wipe capitalism out. The left did not succeed in overthrowing capitalism, but capitalism is doing a fantastic job at inventing the machines that will overthrow capitalism. And the question is, what happens to humanity in the process? Are we going to become appendages to machinery that's owned by the 0.1%, the result being that even the 0.1% will experience a massive decline in their sales, because the rest of us will simply not be able to afford to buy their stuff? Or are we going to turn those machines into our slaves so that humanity can prosper?
On that happy note, Yiannis, I really appreciate you being on the show with us again. Thank you so much. And you know, when this book comes out again in paperback, revised edition, or I'll just be bugging you in the very near future to have you back on the show. It really is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being back on This Is Hell.
Thank you. You do that, because I'm always very, very pleased to be talking to your program.
All right. I appreciate it, Yiannis. Take care.
Thank you.
Former finance minister of Greece, Yiannis Varoufakis, is author of the new book, Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. He really is quickly becoming one of my very favorite guests. Live from the planet where we know the price of everything and the value of nothing, This Is Hell. The New York Times, for whatever reason, loves to ignore Brazil's left. I don't know why, they just do. Our correspondent in Brazil does not ignore Brazil's left. In fact, he actually asked them what they think of the state of their nation. We'll find out what he found out when we speak with our Sao Paulo correspondent Brian Muir in a few minutes. If you want to hear This Is Hell over the air on your local radio station, assuming you still have one, and impose our evil content upon your neighbors, email us your local radio station's call letters to chuck@thisishell.com. And in listener feedback this week, our first email to chuck@thisishell.com, sure enough, we received more suggestions for radio stations to target in our growing Not the Media broadcast empire syndication network, whatever that fronts This Is Hell. Zach writes, Chuck, you should check about getting on at 106.3 WRFZ radio, or Rochester Free Radio. They have lots of good shows like yours. It would fit in well. I'm a good fan. I've been listening regularly for a couple of months now. Keep up the good work. We got another station suggestion from Dan. This Is Hell and WMNF. Who knew that somebody selected the call letters We're Monday Night Football? If you haven't met, I'd like to introduce you to each other. You would be great together. Please consider it. And for the first time, we got a repeat suggestion on a radio station at which we could be broadcasting. This one is from Ron. Hi, Chuck. I live in San Diego, California, full of military and right-wing evangelical crazies. There's a local station devoted to social justice. It is KNSJ in Descanso, California, Eastern San Diego County. Check out their schedule at knsj.org. Signed, Ron, a Patreon supporter in San Diego. During the Patreon podcast this week, I mentioned watching some Forbidden Gospels of the Bible show on History Channel while stoned, and how there was some sect that in fact believed that this is hell. But I, you know, that this actually is hell, that what we're living in is actually hell. But I couldn't remember the name of the sect, as again, I was stoned and I asked about it during the Patreon podcast and I got a response. And I'll be reading it during the Patreon podcast this week. So if you want to know what the religious sect was that actually believed this is hell where we exist today, you're going to have to stay tuned in, or you're going to have to subscribe to our Patreon podcast at thisishell.com/support. This is hell where we put people before profits, which turns out to be a horrible, horrible business model. The New York Times does not talk to the Brazilian left. Why? I don't know. Here to help us figure out why and to find out what the left is up to in Brazil, because you're not going to read about it in the Times, Brian Meir is our correspondent in Brazil. He is an editor at Brazil Wire, a freelance writer and producer who lives in Sao Paulo. Welcome back to This Is Hell, Brian.
Hey, Chuck, how's it going?
It's good, and it's good. It's going well. Listen, I want to get to this as quick as possible because I know I've been getting the Times lately because I can write it off, so it's cheaper. But I get the Times, and I've been reading a lot of the international coverage, which is always like nails on a chalkboard. If you hear our interview with Lucas Kerner from VenezuelaAnalysis.com, he has the exact same problem with New York Times coverage in Venezuela. And you write about how the New York Times ignores Brazil's left. Is the middle class then not a significant portion of the left in Brazil? Because I'm trying to figure out how much Brazil's politics are essentially a class war, that it is the middle class and more wealthy on the right and everybody who is below middle class on the left. Is it a class war, and what does the New York Times miss if they don't talk to the left in a class war?
Yeah, it is a class war. And, I mean, there are some people on the in the middle class who are leftists. There's some prominent left intellectuals. In fact, most of the university professors in Brazil are on the left, which creates a huge problem for foreign correspondents, for mainstream media down here. I've socialized in some of those circles over the years, and it's common to hear people complaining about not being able to find an ideologically aligned professor to give them any commentary about anything. So, but outside of this intellectual middle-class left, which might represent 10%, 15% of the middle class is much more conservative than the working class. Now, because of evangelical churches, unfortunately, we have a growing population of, you know, working-class conservatives. But in general, if you looked at the pro-impeachment or pro-coup protests of last year, it was just a sea of white people. And if you looked at the protests that were held against the impeachment, against the coup, there were 85, 90% black. Brazil is 51% black. It's the largest population of African descendants in the world outside of Africa. And so it's not just class lines, it's also color lines. And it's very rare ever see anyone talking to anyone of color in the mainstream media as well. So the repercussions of never talking to people on the Brazilian left is that you don't provide an accurate portrayal of the Brazilian people, and you don't provide an accurate portrayal of the racial component of Brazil as well.
Do you show an accurate portrayal of Brazilian politics? Because what I was trying to figure out was, while the left may be ignored by Western media, how aware are Brazilians themselves of the people you interviewed on Brazil's left? Are they, is the Brazilian left also marginalized by Brazil's media as they are by the outside Western media outlets, and so therefore there might be some disconnect between the Brazilian public and the Brazilian left? Or is the Brazilian public fully aware of the Brazilian left, that they're not that shunned from popular discourse?
No, I've worked on a series of television productions this year for Al Jazeera's The Listening Post about Brazilian media. And one of the glaring things that is always pointed out is that if you look at the Brazilian media, it's over 95% white middle class. And so if you ever see any leftist commentary appearing in some of the Brazilian media outlets, it's usually a white middle class intellectual. But it's also very rare. Reporters Without Borders, who I have some criticisms and about them as an organization, but they did produce a very good report about the Brazilian media called The Country of 30 Berlusconis. Basically, you have a few very rich families that control all of the major media outlets in Brazil, and they're ideologically aligned. They're all neoliberals. And if you look at Brazilian television, racially, the balance of the newscasters and cast of television shows looks less ethnically mixed than American TV. But the problem is the U.S. is 13% black, Brazil's 51% black. So it's an absurd lack of people of color in the television media and in the print media in Brazil.
You write that there is no doubt that the so-called pink tide of radical and center-left governments that spread throughout the region, throughout Latin America and South America under the George W. Bush administration, is being pushed back, supported by international capital and the U.S. Government. While many members of the OAS, the Organization of American States, did not initially recognize coup governments in Honduras, Paraguay, and Brazil, the quick assent, as in approval, that came from Washington afforded what you call the coup government's international legitimization. So as you have lived in one of those countries that has what you call a coup government that has been legitimized not only by neighbors but by U.S. approval, how much do you get a sense that the people of Brazil feel their country is influenced by, for lack of a less objective term, the U.S.? How much do Brazilians perceive any impact of the U.S. on their national politics? How much is there a sense that the reason that the pink tide was crushed was simply the U.S. Challenges to local national politics?
I think that feeling is very strong in Brazil. And there's, as time moves forward, there's more and more evidence that this was actually the case. You know, a coup doesn't just happen overnight. It involves, normally in the Americas, in the history of U.S.-sponsored coups that have happened dozens of times in the last 100 years in the Americas, there's a period in which the economy is destabilized. We know this happened in Chile in 73 when the ITT Corporation, together with the Nixon administration, worked to create an international boycott of Chile's largest industry, copper, which caused the economy to go into a tailspin. And we see similar things that happened in Brazil in the lead up to the coup. There's a judicial investigation against many of Brazil's largest companies for corruption, which got all kinds of coverage in the New York Times. They hailed this judge, he's both a judge and a prosecutor, in a legal arrangement which goes back to Spanish Inquisition times. In most countries, the prosecutor is not allowed to judge on his own prosecution. But in the case of Brazil, it's still legal. So we have this judge named Sergio Moro, who we know from leaked State Department cables has been working on collaborative efforts to combat corruption with the U.S. State Department and FBI since at least 2009, who launched this massive anti-corruption investigation called Lava Jato. Now, in northern countries, when there's a big corruption and corporate corruption investigation, Normally, they consider the companies under investigation to be too big to fail, as was the case in the subprime mortgage crisis in the U.S., where sleazy companies like Goldman Sachs received billions of dollars from the U.S. government to guarantee that they would still operate during the corruption scandal. You see, in Germany, there was a big corruption scandal with Siemens and Volkswagen. The German government considered those companies too big to fail. And although they jailed some of the perpetrators of the corruption scandal, they did everything they could to make sure the companies continued running. In the case of the Lavoggiato investigation, the prosecutor froze all activities of the five largest construction companies in the country. This caused an immediate 500,000 layoffs in the construction industry and hundreds of thousands of layoffs in companies that depended on the construction industry, like the steel industry and the shipbuilding industry. And some economists say that this action of Lavoggiato accounted for a 2.5% drop in the GDP in 2015 in the lead up to the coup. The fact that Sergio Moro was working together with the U.S. seems to imply that the U.S. collaborated to destabilize the economy before Dilma Rousseff's impeachment, causing her popularity to plummet. So that's one clear example. I mean, when you look at coups, you know, any intelligence analyst would tell you that you have to look at who benefits from it. Okay, and the fact that Brazil is one of the largest petroleum nations in the world, with the largest offshore oil deposits in the world called the pre-salt reserves, that now, after the coup, is being sold off and privatized. They're selling petroleum to companies like Shell, which just invested $10 billion down here, which is hardly a paradigm of transparency and good business. They're selling petroleum for 1 cent per liter. And this is petroleum that previously, the profits of which had been allocated to the public education and health systems, which it's not happening anymore. You know, so just from the privatization of the petroleum, you can see how Northern capital is benefiting from this coup. Another geopolitical interest that the United States had was to weaken the BRICS, the BRIC countries, which is Brazil, Russia, India, and China, South Africa. Together, those economies are bigger than the U.S. They were talking about abandoning the use of the dollar to buy petroleum from Iran. They were creating a development bank to rival the World Bank and doing a lot of things that would irritate or challenge United States hegemony in the world. And so I think those are two clear factors in which the U.S. has benefited from the coup in Brazil.
And as you were saying, the United States has been asking for a privatization of oil, which now the Temer presidency that has taken power through an impeachment process that a lot of outsiders are calling a coup, that you call a coup. The Temer administration wants to bring about this privatization of oil that the United States wanted, is bringing about the elimination of energy self-sufficiency in Brazil that the United States wanted. Is U.S. policy foregoing democracy, rights, and the law in Brazil in order to get profits for U.S. energy corporations in Brazil? Is it that simple, Brian? Is there more to it than that, or is it just that bare bones, bottom line simple? The United States supported an impeachment process that seems to be at the best extra legal, looks like a coup, undermined democracy, brought in a government that is opposed to civil rights, undermined the law within Brazil simply to get more profits for energy corporations in the United States? Is it that simple, or is there more to it than that, Brian?
Okay, first of all, I just want to say something. It's not just outsiders like myself who are calling it a coup. President Michel Temer gave a speech at ASCOA, America's Society, Council of the Americas, Feller-funded corporate think tank that has been involved in many coups in Latin America since its founding in 1962, including the first coup in Brazil in 64. He gave a speech there last October in which he said that Dilma Rousseff was impeached because of her economic platform, because she didn't support the PMDB's neoliberal platform called Bridge to the Future, which seems to have been originally written in English and is 100% Washington consensus. So even the president himself is admitting that it was a coup, because she wasn't impeached over her economic policy legally. She was impeached over an infraction, a non-impeachable offense called fiscal peddling, which she was subsequently exonerated from. So the first point is that even the president is now admitting it was a coup. The second point is petroleum enough, just petroleum alone, is a reason to justify U.S. actions in overthrowing a foreign government. Because if you look at the nation's largest petroleum suppliers, if you look at the world's largest petroleum suppliers, how many of them haven't suffered from U.S. interventions, really, aside from Saudi Arabia? So the fact that it's one of the top 10 oil-producing nations is an argument enough to explain why the U.S. would do something like that. But I think there's other factors at stake. Obviously, it wasn't just the United States, because some of the beneficiaries for the oil privatizations include companies that are based outside of the U.S. The Norwegian government was the first organization to purchase a lot of this offshore oil. But there's other factors. And I think one of the factors that Fidel Castro used to always talk about is hegemony. You know, Brazil's the second largest economy in the Americas. And at the time of the coup, it was the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world. What kind of example does it make to the United States to have another major economy in the Americas that doesn't follow the neoliberal economic policies of the U.S., that provides some kind of alternative? A country that raised its minimum wage by over 100% in real terms, where public university is free, where they have a relatively good public health system by third world standards. This is a thorn in the side of the United States from a hegemony perspective, because the United States is very interested in always promoting the idea that we're the best, we have the best economic model. So in that sense, it's more than just oil, it's hegemony. It's the BRICS and other factors related to those two things.
Brian, I really appreciate you being back on the show. I know that this series that you are writing for the Council on Hemispheric Affairs will be continuing, so we'll have you back on the show next month to continue our discussion on it. Brian Muir is an editor at Brazil Wire and a freelance writer and producer. He's also a correspondent here on This Is Hell. He's our correspondent in Brazil based in Sao Paulo. This week, Brian posted the article, The State of the Brazilian Left, Analysis from an American in Brazil. Thank you so much for being back on the show, and I'll talk to you next month.
All right, take it easy, Chuck.
Thanks. Live from land stolen from the natives, This Is Hell. The best way for you to get the word out about This Is Hell is to share the entire show or individual interviews or correspondence reports. Thanks this week goes out to the following people for sharing This Is Hell: Rich, Julie, Gorilla Gramophonics. Thanks to everyone who shared our interview with Cindy Milstein on the radical power of grief, including Ariana, Michael, Jeffrey, Jan, Anarchist Space Agency, Elliot, Anarchimedia, Alex, and Tom. Tom wrote, "Whoa, probably the best This Is Hell interview ever, the one with Cindy Milstein on Rebellious Morning, and that is saying a lot. This changes several frames of reference and challenges many points of view that I hold. Thanks, Chuck, for always making me reconsider everything I think I know and for making me retool what to do about it." There are also a lot of people who shared our discussion on misogyny with Kate Mann, including Francesco, Doug, James, Gary, and about a dozen more people who shared it anonymously. Also, a lot of people shared our interview with Carl Anthony on the intersection of climate and social justice, including Nick, Mutiny on Spaceship Earth, Monique, New Village Press, and Lynn. Thanks to Mark for sharing This Is Hell. All the people who shared our interview with Alyssa Battistoni last week, who talked about a working class environmental movement, including Jan, Van, food and the environment. And again, a lot of people have shared it anonymously. So thanks to all of you for sharing This Is Hell. Join me for This Is Hell office hours happening this and every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Carrie's Lounge, 2251 West Devon, the bar downstairs from This Is Hell office, from our world headquarters. This Is Hell office hours again every Wednesday, 6 to 9 p.m. Drop by and I'll give you a show-related book and some This Is Hell subvertising stickers. On next week's show, we're back in our regular four-hour format. And do we have a Thanksgiving weekend show for you? Our guests include Andrea Flynn, whose new book is The Hidden Rules of Race, Barriers to an Inclusive Economy. Following Andrea, we'll talk to Sylvia Carrillo, who's the nephew of assassinated activist Berta Cáceres, about new evidence in her killing. Also, journalist Susie Hansen about her book, which just got a review in the New York Times, Notes on a Foreign Country and American Abroad in a Post-American World. We'll talk to Gay Teresa Johnson, who is co-editor of The Future of Black Radicalism. Check out our new mug at thisishell.com/support. Want to thank our guests this week, Brian Meir and Yanis Varoufakis. You can hear the entire show by going to thisishell.com in just a little bit. Thanks to Alex Jerry for producing this week's show. This is not the media. This is hell. There's only one way to get over all of the problems that we've introduced to you on this morning's show. That's by sitting down in the lotus position, turning your palms towards the sky, focusing on that burning white dot in the middle of your forehead, and saying the simple words, everybody's stupid.
My demon is on my butt.
Matt Damon.
My demon talks to me in profanity like a sailor. And my demon tries to knock me down. And my demon tries to put me on a hell ride.